Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and the host of the Jill on Money podcast. Beginning, middle, or end of the year, it's always a great time to take control of your financial life. And the Jill on Money podcast is here to help. Your questions make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and, more importantly, on your life. Follow and listen to Jill on Money wherever you get your podcasts.
Got ladies, it. I said shut up. Don't go, got it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the How To Podcast. I am Luke Anderson. I think that I'm your host, but I may be a co-host. I'm not sure that we've ever really defined roles on here, but thank you for joining us. With me, as always, who?
Oh, I'm Ben. Sorry, I didn't realize that was my...
I try to make them as clunky on purpose because it's always funny to see how you react. So I would say my bad, but my good. I don't know.
I am Ben Abbey. I am the owner of Box Painting. I am the Box Dad on TikTok and Instagram. I play characters like Becky and Ski, and I'm an outdoor enthusiast.
There you go. Outdoor enthusiast. Do you want to talk? Should this be an outdoor episode?
We could do an outdoor episode. It's kind of like, let's talk about why we should do an outdoor episode. Because, and you felt this too, yeah, throughout this whole year from me. I was gone.
You will notice that there was not an October podcast. Yep. This is now November. So it was skipped entirely because you were busy.
Literally, I'm hiking this elk off of a mountain and Luke texts me and he's like, hey, I just wanted to set up this podcast, yada, yada, yada. I was like, bro, I'm gone.
And then you sent me a picture of like, what were they, like 4.5 foot antlers off of a bull elk?
Actually, quite literally, I measured them out. So I took a measurement on
this. Were you talking spread or like base to tip?
So base to tip, he came out.
Wait, if you're starting the podcast right at this point.
It's a bad time. That's bad.
Awkward. I don't know if I like that.
Base to tip on antlers.
Okay, gotcha.
The antler length of the main beam on both sides, he's almost perfectly symmetrical, but he came out right at 46 inches on the length of the beam. I measured him at a total, like, and I'm not a professional measure.
Sure. Yeah. There are two different rating systems.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then state by state, it's either by point or by like you count the total points or you count the points on each side.
And they have this verbiage on there where it's like when you measure, you go to the tip, but you actually
measure. Is that Boone and Crockett measuring? Or are you talking about, like, yeah, what's the other one?
The curve, you measure up to the curve around the curve of the tip. And so it gets really convoluted. But at the end, we know that this bull is a 300 to maybe a 320 inch bull as far as his class. So he's a 300 class bull. His inside spread is 42 inches. Outside spread is almost 4 feet. He is, he's a special animal. So
biggest bull you've seen
ever. So biggest bull I've seen in Oregon, hands down. Never have I seen a bull that size in Oregon. I have been to Estes Park in Colorado. That's, and seen bigger elk there as far as their mass. But that's what you expect to see in a freaking national park. That's where they're going to be. This animal was very special.
Where were you geographically in the state?
Sure. Yeah. So we are all the way east in Oregon, literally in the picture. And I need to post it on IG, honestly. But in the picture.
Oh, good. Because that's where I'll see it.
On the other side of the ridge is the Snake River.
Okay.
And, you know, there's a lot of factors that helped this season for us as elk hunters, rifle hunters in Oregon. We had a really dry summer. It was a really dry summer all the way through it. And that, I really think, pushed their rut back out of September into the October and even almost November timeframes. And what we were experiencing through deer season in the beginning of October was we were seeing elk in full throat. Like, we were like, wow, these guys are ramped up hard. And then,
and it feels like usually what they do is they try to align the rut with archery season, because it's a lot harder to get 40 yards from an animal. So that's just for anybody that's like, well, why does that matter? But yeah, so usually September is your archery season.
Archery season. And then October, we moved to rifle seasons. Yep. And so as we got into the beginning of rifle season, so for those of you who don't know and didn't experience it with me, I was gone for 10 days elk hunting, and it was no contact. It drove my painters crazy. This was the first time where I literally, like, normally I can get a little bit of contact where I make calls, do emails, stuff like that as I'm facilitating the elk hunt, whatever that is. And I wasn't able to do that because I had gotten this bull, and my buddy had gotten a bull also in the same time frame. And so I wasn't.
And when you say the same time frame, this is not in the same 10 days.
No, within a minute of each other. Within a minute of each other, both of these animals had died, and you know,
died or been killed.
So been killed. I mean, so we can get into the emotions of it. So let's describe how I hunt elk, because I think that's important. We show up to elk camp. There's four of us. It's me and my buddy, Joe, who we've known each other now. We're coming up on 22 years, somewhere in there. And Joe's father, Kevin, and my father, his name's Richard. We're all together on this elk hunt. We have a 12 by 20 wall tent, the Alaknak series from Cabela's. It's glamping. In this camp, this is glamping. We have these massive cots with three dogs, my dog, my dad's dog, Joe's dog, right? And we are all just cozy in the camp, loving
wood stove in the in the tent, I'm sure.
Wood stove there, and the wood stove is always burning. It is comfy.
Because let's be honest, if you go out 2 days in a row in bad weather hunting, one day you are soaked to the bone. The next day, all of that stuff stays in the tent with the wood stove to dry it out. Come on. This is
absolutely
elk hunting 101.
Elk hunting 101. And it's nasty weather out there. And so as elk season was approaching, we saw the weather and it was coming to change. The weather was going to change and it was going to get nasty quick. And to be clear, the first snowfall that happened happened on the opening morning of season. We get about 3-4 inches of snow. But what we do, Joe and I, and this is because of an experience that we had in 2017, I was with another buddy of mine, Mike, and we come up on top of this ridge, first light, we're on top doing our thing, hear a bugle. Mm-hmm. And we hear the bugle, we move to the bugle, we find the bull, and I'm waiting, and Mike's the shooter, and we're waiting for the bull to come into the open, and out from the trees on the other side of the canyon are three little ninjas that come out and pop that bull at about 200, 300 yards, somewhere right in there, right out from underneath us. And what we figured out was that they had camped on top of that ridge the night before. So they had heard that bull probably bugling all night.
Yeah.
So ever since then, when we draw first season bull, that's what we do. We camp out up on top. So,
how far is that hike in?
That hike it's 3 miles, 2.5-3 miles.
Okay.
But you are gaining 2,500 feet of elevation over the first three quarters of a mile.
And how much of that glamping gear do you bring in?
Zero. So we go in with a 2-man tent, a sleeping bag, and then extra water and dehydrated food.
Yeah.
Like the mountain house meals, right? Gravy,
I had some of those and I looked at them the other day, expiration 2050.
You're good to go. You're good.
Just throw them in.
And they're not bad. If I'm honest, like, they're not bad meals either.
Yeah.
For the record.
For the price and for the, everything is completely dehydrated. Yeah.
And to the degree that in this tent, we literally just break fir boughs off and we're sleeping on fir boughs. Like we're roughing it up on top of that little knob. And we got to the top. So we typically, you know, the hunt starts on a Wednesday. We arrive on a Tuesday. We get to the top of that mountain on the Tuesday. And then the idea is that our fathers are going to come up the same ridge the next morning or that same series of ridges the next morning.
They're still glamping.
They're glamping the night before, and our job is to find elk, and then most likely they're going to run off this ridge down toward our fathers.
Yep.
If we don't get a shot at them first. That night, or so we get to the top of that ridge on Tuesday night. This is a fun hunting story. Within 15 seconds, we spot elk. Like quite literally 15 seconds. Joe's got his binoculars up and he's like, there's a bull. And my bet would be that the bull that we first saw was the bull that Joe ultimately would get the next morning.
Yeah.
And it had a spike and a cow with him. And then we get our camp set up and we hear an elk bugling on in the next drainage over that we are going to go take a look at regardless. And so we get up there and we very quietly are just looking over these elk. We can't see the bull that is bugling down in the bottom of this drainage, but we can hear the cow that's mewing.
Yep.
And then what we do observe is there are probably 50 to 60 elk, and each little pod of them has a branch bull, like a satellite bull, away from this main one that's bugling. And each of these branch bulls are good 6 points, maybe a good five. I mean, and there's four of them that are around this area. And yeah. So Joe and I that night were like, if these other bulls are 6 points, how big is this freaking bull that's bugling down there? How, like, the idea being that how afraid are these bulls?
Yeah.
These look like good bulls for our area. How afraid are these bulls of this bull? If how big is he? Like, yeah. are we talking? And so we went to bed not knowing. This bull, the last thing I heard that night as I closed my eyes to go to sleep at 9 o'clock was the sound of that bull bugling still. He was still just ripping them.
Yeah.
All night long. We wake up to 4 inches of snow and we're socked in pretty hard, and meaning that we got fog.
Yep.
And can't look down, but the bull is still bugling. They're literally in the exact same place we left them. They didn't even move up the drainage. They're just smack right where we left them.
They're just in there fornicating, those filthy animals.
Pretty much.
Yep.
I mean, you know, they're just very Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah. There. Oh yeah. It's just elk Caligula going on down there.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Joe and I make a plan. And for those of you that hunt, fish, whatever you do out there, when you're making the plan, the understanding is that this plan's not going to work. Like that's
how accurate.
You make the
plan. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down this ridge. And then what happens? You're like, I think I heard something over there. Wait, what's that? Exactly. The next thing you know, off the trail. And that's like 17 steps into the woods.
Absolutely.
Like a big squirrel goes running by you. Like, that sounded like might have been something. And then you go over there and it's just a gray squirrel. But now you're off the path. And then you're like, what's on the other side of that ridge? And now you're going perpendicular to your original path. Yes.
Exactly. Right. The plan never goes the way that you expected it to. So Joe,
and that's without seeing animals.
And that's without seeing animals. Yeah. We know where these animals are. The good news here is that we have snow that morning. For those of you that hunt, snow is a scent killer. Fresh snow, boom, lays all scent down. And so wind becomes almost a non-factor. And we're so socked in with the fog also as it's moving in and out of these mountains, because we are right above the snow line. That we're also able to move across open ground in fog, mm-hmm. because we've been up here before. We know how to move to places quick, but we need cover to do it. And so Joe's moving down toward where we saw the original bull in that 15 seconds. He's going to go down that ridge. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to, the idea being that either I'm going to shoot first and run the animals down to Joe, or he's going to shoot first and the animals are going to run up the drainage to me.
Yep.
And
in theory,
it's all in theory. You never know how they're going to react. You never
the elk plan. Never follow the plan. Whatever never, you draw up, the yeah, wild animals, not real keen to the plan.
So I get to my spot and Joe knows where I'm going to be. Joe, like as far as like very specifically knows where I'm going to be standing and how I'm going to react. And that comes from just hunting together for a long time and knowing this spot so well. And what ends up happening is I get kind of pinned where I can't actually drop down as far as I thought I would be able to, because there are elk, six cow elk sitting 250 yards to my right below me, away from the rest of the herd. But this other bull is still bugling down there. we sat in the snow, or I sat in the snow for about 2 hours. As I'm watching Joe move down, I see him at certain points moving down the ridge, and he's making his circle, but I can't move, and he knows I can't move because I'm pinned with elk. And at some point I come to the conclusion that basically this is going to be on Joe.
Yeah.
Joe's going to need to be the one that's going to make a move on him because he has better wind than I would. And he's a little bit more covered. So right, and I have video of it where I actually record the bull bugling below me. So I have him bugling on recording, which is awesome. And right at about 9:30, 9:45, Joe cracks his first shot. And for those of you that don't hunt, I could tell that the shot was a miss just by the way it echoed off the canyon. But because the follow-up shot was a little bit delayed, and then I could hear that shot, I knew that the second shot, we had a bull down. Like there's a thud that happens on a shot at distance that you're like, that's a hit.
You can hear a bullet traveling, then all of a sudden it stops.
Yep. After the first shot, right? Both Joe and I have not seen this bugling bull. He's been ripping them all morning, but we haven't made eye contact with him, right? Yep. And all of a sudden, as Joe takes that first shot, the elk start filtering out of the trees. Mm-hmm. He herds them all up, right? And they start moving. And my job now at this point is I got to get up, make sure I stay above them and block, right? Now, 2 years ago, I had something similar in experience happen in this very same spot, but the animals were moving down the other way. This was on a spike hunt, and I had a branch bull with a herd run below me, and they had no spikes in that group. But from that vantage, I knew that that shot was right around 375 yards.
Okay.
And that's just based on memory and what we've done before. Well, elk and the way they move and the way they herd, elk, the cows move first, the bulls stay behind and are moving those animals out. As he comes out of the trees, I watch him with my binoculars bugle, right? And I'm like, oh, that's you. There you are.
Yeah.
And at that point, the adrenaline is beginning to rush and I'm not focused on his size. I just know that's the one that I want to target. But there's other bulls that are with him.
And the adrenaline is crazy just when you see your first elk.
Oh, yeah.
Then you see antlers. Then you kind of go into an entirely different mode.
And I said this in to Joe in the beginning, that I was glad that we never saw the bull.
Because you wouldn't have slept.
If I would have seen this bull the night before or even that morning.
Yep.
That buck fever, that elk fever, whatever you want to call it, it just ramps right up.
Yep.
You can't, and it's tough to harness. So at this point, the bull is moving his cows, about 40 or 50 of them, up the canyon, and with relative haste. They know that they're moving away from danger, but they're not moving at full tilt.
Yeah.
I get down to where I know I want to shoot from on the edge of this brush, and I get my little shooting sticks out, and I'm just rock solid on this spot. And the cows move out. And he comes across the opening, and my first shot was a moving shot, and I hit him on the first one, end up taking out his lungs. He couldn't take another step forward. The way that the sound bounces off these canyons, the elk thought that the shot was coming from their side. They're on the opposite side of the canyon. They think it's coming from their side because of the way it echoes. And so the cows all of a sudden come back and just surround him.
Yeah.
He hit. He's not down, but they surround him. And I can't take my second shot because I need these cows to clear. So as that's happening, Joe comes over the radio, right? And now I've got my pouch, my little binocular pouch right here. I've already taken
on your chest for people listening to this.
Sorry, for the people listening. And on my chest with the binoculars is my radio.
Yep.
Joe comes over the radio after I've taken my first shot and says, I've got a bull down. And I come back over the radio after my first shot and I'm waiting for these cows to clear. And I say, Joe, I just need a couple more seconds and we're going to have two. And sure enough, the cows clear. I take my shot and drop him, right? Like right in his tracks. And that was fantastic. I was excited, all that fun stuff. And then the elk, they continue going up the canyon. Our fathers are on the other side of that canyon. and they know that shots are being fired, yada, yada, yada. I come over the radio and they, or yeah, over the radio, and they know that we've got 2 6-points down. Now, typically, our fathers do not come all the way up the hill. They're relatively old. They're 60 plus. Sure, Joe's yeah. getting almost 70. And they don't make this climb all the way to the top. We keep them at about halfway just for that reason.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Save the steps.
As I'm approaching my bull, I got within about, it was right around when I got about 100 yards away from him as I'm walking to him, you know, I was like, oh, you're a freak. Like, this is not like, we've experienced pretty typical bulls.
There's right? a nice bull on your wall behind you that nobody can see because we're recording this for audio purposes. That bull, when did you get that one?
2019.
That is about what? 2/3 the size? Half the size of the...
I think he's half. I bet he would measure about half the size.
And you took the time to put a nice English mount on that one because that's a nice bull.
It is a nice bull. He's a great 6x7.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do with the...
That's a typical Oregon bull. Like very Pacific Northwest Rocky Mountain bull.
A handful of years ago, my brother and my dad both got one just about that size. Very nice.
Very nice bull. Respectable bull, right? Like very respectable. You're going to put it on the wall. Like in 2019, I said, this might be the biggest bull I ever killed. And I truly believe that.
Yep.
And I am not a trophy hunter for anybody that's listening. It's not what I do. Whatever comes across me first, it's a legal animal. Boom. I'm after it. That's what I want to do.
And then you eat the meat and you enjoy it. Yep.
So as I approached the bull, I figured out how big he was. And that
is the thing that you don't realize is until you walk right up. Well, and the other thing too, until an elk is down, like you never get that close to an elk. The size of a small elk is big. They are huge animals, but you get a monster like that.
So I get to the bull and I'm getting ready to do my thing. And as I go to lift like his head for the first time, I'm like, oh no. I call my dad and I was like, listen, on the radio, I'm like, dad, you're going to have to climb this hill. He's huge. I can't physically move him the way that I normally would be able to move most animals. I can't do it.
And your buddy Joe is already dealing with his own 6-point. Yeah. So
a mile away doing his own thing.
Well, and so I've never gotten an elk. So I've been on hunts where my dad and my brother have, and just being there trying to just move the mass around to skin it.
Just negotiate it safely.
Yep.
Oh yeah. You're with knives, you're doing your thing, you know, and it's a slippery, disgusting mess, right? But you got to get it cleaned up. And so dad's like, okay, it's going to take me a couple hours to get to where you are. And I was like, no problem. I'm just going to start cutting away and get them worked out.
Get out the bone saw. Let's get to work.
It was insane. Yeah. So dad ultimately would make it to the top of the ridge. And by the time dad gets to the top, it's about 2 PM in the afternoon at that point.
Is Richard going to Joe's kill then?
So yeah, Richard decides that he gets to the top and then he meets us at where we camped that night.
Gotcha.
And to save my father's legs for the next day, cause now we've got work to do and we know we've got work.
Yep.
The next 4 days are about to be real hard.
Quick. And this is, you guys just took out meat, no pelts. You took out the horns.
Yep. Horns.
Did you weigh the meat?
Yeah.
How much each?
Okay. So,
cause I want people, like if people are listening and are actually intrigued by this and have never been hunting, this is no bones.
No bones. Pelt,
and think of how heavy the pelt is on an elk. I mean, that is some thick hair.
And then you have the intestines. You have
everything. So I mean, just the meat as clean as you can get it off the bone.
So to give you an idea in perspective, also a standard spike bull that we've taken spikes before, we typically get about 150 to 180 pounds of meat off of a spike.
Yep.
Meat only. Spike bull, 150, which means it's an immature animal, right?
Yep.
But like 200 pounds of meat, that's a solid amount of meat. Almost 200 pounds. I ended up turning in to the meat market. I turned in 261 pounds of just meat.
Yeah.
261. That does not include the 45 inch long back straps.
Yep.
I'm not kidding. Like,
I believe you.
They are massive. Sure. I've never seen anything
this
like
is, this is your tenderloin on a cow. Yeah. And what's the circumference on those?
Oh, I would say, what is that? 7 inches?
Yeah.
7 inches or 7 inch radius.
Circumference is all the way across.
Okay. Thank you.
You're a hunter. You don't have to be a geometry.
I'm not here for geometry.
Major.
But yeah, 7 inches, right? I figure they're about 7 inches. And to give you an idea, that was at least another 40 pounds of meat. And the reason I know that is because each of those steaks cut up into a little 1 inch, we're looking for 1 inch steaks. I have a little over 80 steaks from this bowl. It's insane.
Yeah.
When I showed up to the meat market, we've been going to the same guy for, it's Mount Angel Meats here in Oregon. They do the Oktoberfest sausages.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The owner's name is Eric, fantastic human being. I showed up and I just happened to have the bull, the head with me, and because I was taking it to the taxidermist that same day that I brought the meat out. And I open up the back and I get the head out and Eric comes out and he goes, "Wow, that's the biggest Oregon bull I've ever seen." Yeah. I've seen bigger ones come out of New Mexico. I've seen bigger ones come out of Montana. That is the biggest Oregon bull I've ever seen. That is a freak.
Yeah. Well, he was an Idaho bull the day before, and then he just sauntered across.
So here's
he doesn't give any care to the state boundaries.
No, none at all. But interesting theory that we actually have on that note, as far as animal migrations and kind of the way they work. For those of you that know, here in Oregon, we had a dry summer, and just north of my unit was the biggest forest fire we had. It was the Cedar Creek fire.
Yeah.
And fire, typically speaking, it's not that animals don't die in forest fires. They absolutely do. They get trapped. They get surrounded. They don't make it out. But for those that do make it out, it displaces animals. Yeah. All of a sudden, you run to places that they weren't normally at.
Well, and there's also not a huge casualty list. It's not like when you say some animals do, it's most of them are far more aware of what is happening to their surroundings than we do.
Think Bambi, right? Like, get out. Bambi, they're running from that fire. They don't stick around. They're boom, gotta go.
Yeah, you don't go up there and pick up jerky after a forest fire.
Absolutely not. So the way we described it was we thought that this animal looked more like the unit that was above us, that would come out of that unit. And it would not be surprising to find that out as far if we got the genetics back and figure all that out. Because
did you send it into 23andMe or 23andMeat?
I don't know if OBFNW does that. Maybe they do.
Yeah.
But yeah. So at the end of that, I had a little over 300 pounds. Joe ended up with a little over 200 pounds off of his 6-point. And so in that 4 or 5 day period, we ended up moving over 500 pounds of meat.
I'm sorry. Did you take the horns? What do those weigh?
Oh yeah. My guy's head with horns, no hide on the head.
Yep.
Came in at 45, 47.
So there's another 100 pounds. So you're taking 600 pounds. I mean, the head of an animal.
Well,
it's big.
For those that know the area, it's called Hell's Canyon. Yeah. It's steep. Right. It's what it is. I had his antlers on my back
and they were touching the ground.
As I'm going down the hill, his antlers, his tines would drag and actually shove me forward, making it very uncomfy going down these hills. Yeah. It was a very sketchy prospect. I'm not gonna lie. Like, as far as a safety thing, it was safe, but I was not comfy in what was going on with the head on my back. Because the other thing too is when you have that weight, it gets caught on branches. It gets caught on all that. So the thing that I would say on this elk that was the most fascinating is my father's killed a big bull before up there. Nothing like this guy. And we thought he was just a giant. But once we put my bull up against dad's bull, it was like, it's not even close.
Yeah.
It's 30 to 40 inches of mass more.
Yeah, you're going to need a bigger room if it's going to be on the wall next to its buddy.
100% honesty there. I don't have space in the house for this animal right now. I don't know where it's going to go. But
just put it outside. Put it on the front door. Do you know anybody that can do a nice paint job around it? Something to highlight it?
Just center the whole thing around it. It was very exciting, though, as far as an experience. You know, this last year, I spent, through the summer, through spring and summer, I would say I ended up spending 90% of my weekends outdoors. I was whether I was with the kids.
Yeah, or you're looking for sunstones and doing everything. We talked about quite a bit of it. Yeah.
Huckleberries, mushrooms.
Ooh,
I mean,
huckleberries. Do you go chanterelle hunting?
Yeah, a little bit.
My brother is very, very aware of the chanterelle population beneath his feet as he's hunting. Mm-hmm. And most of the meals that I've had with chanterelles, which like you go to restaurants and they charge a premium for a dish with those. Most of the time it is camp gruel with these, you know, expensive exotic mushrooms that people travel all around for.
Absolutely.
But you go in these hunting areas and they don't, you know, you don't see a lot of mushroom pickers. Every once in a while you do, but they know that like, well, there's guys with guns out there. I'm going to just kind of hang back.
They typically will. Yeah. A lot of mushroom hunters will avoid areas that they know are active hunting zones. It's kind of like being a kayaker on a river for fishing. You know, it's that
it's respect.
Once the season, the season begins. So at the end, you know, this animal, it was the fascinating part for us was, so my dad, because we wanted to save his legs, dad decided him and Joe would stay up the second night. Right.
Yeah.
So that he was up on top to start helping Joe move animals up.
Did they just build a meat canoe and then just like sled down the hill on it, or a meat toboggan, I guess it would be.
If we could have, we would have. I mean, it was so intense. It was so intense physically.
How's the trail going in there to that top spot?
There's no trail. It's not an actual trail. I mean, there's but there's no improved trail. This is we are off the, there's no,
I just want people to get a picture of it. Cause that's kind of what I suspected.
Yeah. And actually Joe and I kind of talked about that, you know, there are hunters out there, you know, and I'm not here to badmouth any style of hunting. You do you, because each area is different. You know, in the East Coast, you have a lot of stand hunters that sit over bait and that's what they do. This is not that kind of hunting.
Yep.
You know, people often ask, you know, what's the largest barrier to elk hunting? It's physicality. You have to be able to get to where they are, because these animals do not mess around. Where they hide is big and tall, big and steep, and they move a lot faster than we can.
Yeah.
And so to be
they catch wind of you and pew,
they're just gone, you know.
And they just, it's amazing that you can have a herd of 40 animals in tall timber
and you don't even
vanish.
Yep.
Just vanish. The mighty Wapiti.
So this elk was so big, to give you an idea, he had muscles that we'd never seen before. And the biggest were at his neck.
Oh yeah. Right? Well, yeah. Think of holding that apparatus above you the whole time.
Going up, he had these two tubes on his neck going the length of his neck. They were just, they looked like loins. They looked
muscle tubes.
Just straight muscle. I've never seen anything like it. His hams were so big that I couldn't physically lift them up high enough to get them into the game bag.
Yeah.
So I trimmed meat off the top round to be able to just lift the ham and make it a manageable, what typically is a 6-bag operation, right? For meat off of an elk.
Yeah.
Mine took 9.5, 10 bags.
Shh.
I mean, he was that much more.
Yeah. And you're talking about what, like 40, 50 pounds per bag, something like that.
Yeah. If there was one bag of meat that had gotten loaded up, and it that one probably weighed about 85 pounds. And, as we shuttled it down, it just kept being the dreaded bag.
Here's the thing that happens too, is you kind of clean off as much meat as you can. And then, you know, if it's a spike, you go, all right, let's get everything. Let's get between the ribs and do the whole thing. Yeah. How much do you think you left on that gun? That's enough.
Oh, none. Actually, we picked him clean. Okay. We did a really good job. We picked him clean.
Because that's an exhausting process, too. Just.
Oh, yeah.
Cleaning just the animal.
The meat. I mean, just quartering them out and deboning. Yeah. I mean, it is everything about it becomes a physical process. Mm-hmm. As we were cleaning out my bowl, no joke, my dad is now, so day two, my dad, we've got Joe's bowl to the top camp.
Yep.
And dad has come down to where my bowl is and is starting to start work on mine. And I meet up with him after getting Joe's bowl to the top. And all of a sudden, the herd from yesterday yesterday has now gotten pushed from other hunters up above back down to where they were. My dad had a shot at 200 yards at this whole herd again, and could have taken a branch, could have taken a spike, and they would have been up the hill closer.
Yeah.
Right. Dad and I looked at each other and we're like, and we're cleaning this animal. And he's like, do we want a third animal? I was like, no, we don't have
not,
the damage.
Not unless you can call in like the backups to come and help us move
exactly.
it out.
And I think that's one thing that as a hunting party, we do good at is we're not greedy about it. Like, what am I going to do? What are me and my dad going to do with another 200-300 pounds of meat?
Yeah.
Like here we are. See, like that's plenty of meat for the next coming year, if not more. And so,
well, the next step of the episode we do of this podcast will be in person, and I will trade you some salmon fillets if need be to trade it for a piece of that tenderloin if possible.
I will bring some up. Oh, absolutely.
God, backstrap. Oh,
So for a bugling bull, you typically expect them to be a little stinky as far as their meat because they're rutting and that's it, the hormones are running. This animal, none of that.
Oh.
I mean, he is absolutely pristine. It was a neat experience. You know, the crazy part for me is that I've drawn first season bull, 2018, 2019, and then 2022. I am currently 3 for 3.
There you go. Well, I mean, that's why it's a draw season, not a full hunting season. I mean, it makes a difference. Not having that many people around makes a big difference. The animals can settle down a little bit more. And then they're just not as skittish. You get into that late season and you've already lost, you know, you lost Jerry to Joe and Glenn got taken out by Ben. And then
I named this bull when we get him back from the taxidermist. His name's Reveille because he was bugling that morning.
Mm.
Bugle, Reveille.
Sure.
So that's I've decided his name is Reveille.
There you go.
He is, you know, he's definitely special. It's something else.
Well, the adrenaline, I don't know what to compare it to. You and I've talked about this, I think on this podcast, I've gotten one deer in my life.
Yeah.
I've gotten one deer and I've told my family too. I go, cause I'm not the most avid hunter, but my family is, they're committed to it. But I moved away from the Northwest for a long time. But when I came back, I got my first animal and I was like, dude, I pondered how different my life would have been if I had gotten one earlier because the sensation is unlike anything else.
It is.
Now, the deer I got was bigger than anything my brothers have ever gotten, and it was almost as if the horns were sturdier, but not as big of a spread as the biggest one my dad ever got. But it's a gnarly click-a-tat deer that is, you know, part mule deer, part whitetail.
Oh, bench-leg,
black tail,
bench-leg deer, yeah.
Just a gnarly mutant of a deer. And same thing, like the neck on that animal to hold up a rack like that. It's crazy. It's
different. I don't know what else to say. At the end of the day.
How about this? So you've gotten the animal. So now, okay. If this is how to elk hunt.
Okay.
Now, how do you enjoy it and share it? Obviously you're sharing the story. You and I sharing the story is fantastic. I've enjoyed hearing it. The picture that you sent me was great because it's you standing next to this girl like, holy hell, dude. Yeah. Like this like
happened.
No words. Just like, I'm like, all right. But like you share the meat. How do you get it processed? Oh. Like what's, you know, you've gotten great the question. Animal. Now what? You've got, you know. Yeah.
So for those that are avid outdoorsmen, or maybe you have an avid outdoors person that is in your family, I think a common thread that happens is I explained this to my now ex, Hannah, years before we were divorced, because we had family and friends asking for meat of a bull that I had taken, maybe even this bull back in 2019. And this is how I explain it. So for those of you that don't know, the heart is the best cut of meat on all animals. There is nothing like it. Heart tastes the best. And so in my mind, heart is always for the hunting party.
Yeah.
Those that are on the hunt get to enjoy the heart. Typically the heart, the way that we prepare it,
just raw, eat it like an apple, pass it around.
Not even close.
No. Oh, right now. We do it differently. I
do not eat raw heart. Although you could.
I suppose you could, yeah.
You can. It's totally fine for you.
I'm sure that you can.
First you soak it for a day, a 24-hour period. You soak it in a bucket of water, flush out all that, all the blood, the clots, all that, get that done. And then you trim off all the all the arteries, yep. Right? You can eat the arteries, but they're really tough. I mean, that's what's making the heart go, sure. Right? So you're trimming all that out, and then you just are left with these really fine cuts of little nuggets that are the heart meat. Fry it up in butter, and that's all you need. Salt, pepper, butter, maybe a little Johnny seasoning. Nothing special.
You can do a little garlic salt.
Yeah. But you want to taste.
Yep.
Like your goal is not to over season there. You want to taste all of that. So that the heart is for hunting party. And then my next favorite cut of meat would be the tenderloin.
Sure.
Tenderloin comes back home. Tenderloin, I will share with immediate family only, pretty much. Right? Like it is just boom. Here's the circle. You get tenderloin. Tenderloin is found on the inside of the body cavity, toward the back end, underneath the lower spine.
Yeah,
it's a muscle that's rarely used, and that's why it is so quote unquote tender. His tenderloins were massive too. Everything about the animal was just upgraded. The next third cut best meat for me is the backstrap.
Yeah.
Backstrap is.
Yeah, I would put backstrap too, but that's just me.
Hey, I get it. I get it. Everybody has their flavors. So backstrap are your steaks. Yeah. And the backstrap literally are two strips of meat that run along both sides of the spine. And if you were a butcher, this is where you would get tomahawk steaks. So you have a rib bone meeting the meat, and that could be a tomahawk steak. And the back strap itself runs quite literally from neck to rump. I mean, they are, and it's one singular piece of meat on each side. Typically has near zero fat on it because of where it is. And it's very lean across the board. And then from there, you get into your roasts, your top sirloins off the rump. Maybe some top shoulder meat is going to be high quality stuff. But a lot of that for us in the processing becomes sausage or burger.
Or pepperoni sticks.
Teriyaki pepperoni sticks. So for me, hunting for the years that I have and having children, you get familiar with what your kids are willing to eat and what they're not.
Yeah.
And the thing is it's fascinating. It has nothing to do with the taste of the meat. It has to do with the texture of the meat. Mm-hmm. So for us, I go massive amounts of burger.
Yep.
I think I ended up doing 80 pounds of summer sausage in 4-pound sticks, right? So you're going to get some of that in your Christmas basket this year from me, along with a handful of other goodies. And then teriyaki sticks. So what I figured out is, they make great Oktoberfest sausages, but I'm the only one that really enjoys those. Like at the end of the day, knowing that my goal is to use and utilize every bit of this animal that I possibly can, this is how I approach it, is making these things into cuts of meat that are going to be for the family. And then from there, I'll hand out the summer sausage. I'll hand out the burger. I'll hand out some roasts. I'll hand out some steaks. No problem with that at all. But the cuts of meat that are for me and immediate family, I guard them. It is that way. Like I want to enjoy backstrap steaks for the next year and a half. So I go skinny on handing those out. And I do have friends and family that offer to pay me for some meat, and I certainly appreciate that. They don't need to pay. I'm happy to give some out as gifts. Because the other thing too is that you're helping me not have to go buy a whole nother freaking freezer. That's kind of where we're living right now, is we need another freezer. The processing of the meat is a neat thing. The other thing I do is we figured out that we enjoy bringing some of the meat off on the bone back with us. So meaning we just quarter the hams or the shoulders and bring meat, because the structure stays on your back better. Instead of a sack of meat just hanging on your hips, the structure on the bone just carries up the back a lot better, and it's easier to pack, even though you probably have an extra 8 to 10, 12 pounds of bone on your back. So, but because we do bring bone back, one dish that I enjoy that I learned from Steve Rinella, who is the does the show on Netflix called Meat Eater. Steve Rinella does a moose hunt up in Alaska, and after they get this moose down, they saw the bones up into the little medallions, the little leg bone femurs into medallions, and then they cook the bone marrow on a fire. And I did something similar because his bones were so big. There's a lot of marrow in there that's worth going after, because marrow is insanely protein rich, huge proteins. But if you do eat too much, it can really mess up your stomach because it's that rich. But what I do is I Traeger the medallions of bone until they are cooked. And then I took the huckleberry jam that I had gotten in the summer, reduced that down a little bit to where it was more, instead of like a jam, it was more of like a reduction.
Yep. Phase. Syrup. Yeah,
exactly. And just poured that over him. That one right there, that's something special. for those of you that I do get into eating the things that I go out and harvest, and enjoying that as a, it's part of honoring what happens out there.
There you go.
Right. Like, cause I come to this belief that, you can test this theory, right? Where not everybody is designed or has the wherewithal to take life, right? Yeah. The taking of life, and I understand what I'm doing. It is taking life. It is. So in that concept, the respect and honor that I want to have for the animal that I have just removed from this earth is great. A lot of times I get into conversations with non-hunters, non-outdoors people, that it is, how can you do this? You know, this is a life. How can you have no emotion? Oh, no. The emotion that I have, I cry.
Man, that's going to be good steak.
Well, no, it's, I cry over it. Like, I get so emotional that it brings me to tears. I can't think of a big game animal that I have not shed a tear over. When I approach the animal, it is this, you see that life leaving its body, and it's like, okay, this is what just happened. And then to be able to process it and then compartmentalize it into this is for the betterment of my family, right? I'm not going to have to buy red meat for 2 years at least now. The betterment of my family, the population of the animals also, because whether we want to like it or not, this animal at his age, because he was aged at about 5 or 6 years old by ODF&W, most bull elk do not live beyond 7. It's just boom.
When they hit a point where they're not breeding anymore and they're just preventing younger bulls from breeding, and there's all of those things.
Yeah. And because, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but when they enter rut and they're bugling like that, they don't eat. They fight and they procreate. That is it.
There's another F word you could use there instead of.
There is. And I just,
You thought about it.
I did. I was
it's a podcast. We're not under FCC guidelines. You can go nuts on the F words.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Don't give me a free pass.
Well, you get a free pass. If you do it, don't feel bad. That's my whole thing.
So that idea that they go through this very arduous process for about a month and a half where they're not consuming any food, and then they enter winter depleted on energy, and they don't have the fat reserves to live for winter or through winter. That is why a lot of them die. Mm-hmm. They die just out of starvation. That is a slow and painful death.
Yeah.
It really is. It hurts. And knowing that this animal is not going to go through that process, I feel better about that. And nature gets to have its peace too. The carcass is out there. The hide is out there. There is a bear in that canyon that has two bull elk down. I guarantee that bear lives all the way through winter with cubs. Yep. Guarantee it.
There you go. You just saved a bear's life.
Yeah.
Now, when you go bear hunting next year, it'll be a whole different story, but.
But there is that process. And I certainly enjoy being a part of that process because it is unique and it is special. And at the end of the day, you know, people that argue that, hunting really is just this archaic form of, it is archaic in the idea that that is how we are hunters and gatherers by nature. It is arguably more weird that you don't want to hunt. You could make that argument based on how we evolve as humans.
You know what? I do is I just avoid the argument. We don't need to argue about it. This is something I do. You don't.
I don't typically circles that aren't hunting outdoor enthusiasts, but yeah. You know, being able to utilize the entire animal, because even, you know, for the bones that I didn't cut up into the marrow medallions, I slow cook them in the Traeger, and then Indy has bones for
there you go.
Coming year.
Ladies and gentlemen, How to Elk Hunt. If you want to hear any of our other podcasts, we have plenty of them. Just go on to odyssey.com, search How To with Luke and Ben. It's fun to hear your story and see your enthusiasm. And yeah, you're right. It's not for everybody, but if it is for you and you want to learn more about elk hunting, I am sure that you can contact Ben. What's the best way to do it?
I am the Box Dad on TikTok. You can contact me in DMs on IG, or always simple email ben@boxpainting.com.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Ben. And thank you everybody for listening.
Thank you so much.
The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses. Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.